In the last couple of decades, scientists have gone from believing that planets like Earth were extremely rare in our universe to now believing that there are literally billions of Earth-type planets in our galaxy alone. In our next presentation, Mr. Stanton Friedman speaks to the ever-growing body of scientific evidence that we are not alone as intelligent species in the galaxy, much less in the entire universe. Mr. Friedman holds undergraduate and graduate degrees in physics from the University of Chicago, a nuclear physicist by training. He has worked for such companies as General Electric, General Motors, Westinghouse, TRW Systems, Aerojet General Nucleonics, and McDonnell Douglas. His works has included highly advanced and highly classified secret programs such as a nuclear aircraft, fission and fusion rockets, and compact nuclear power plants for space and terrestrial applications. He is the original civilian investigator of the world-famous Roswell UFO incident, having co-written the top-selling book about the case, Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident. And I believe he's here. He's coming down here, Mr. Stanton Friedman. Let's give him a round of applause, please. He will be giving us a lecture on a new view of the cosmos.
Is everybody awake? Then you can wake me up. I was on a late show last night. We're at a strange point in history. We have cruised along thinking of ourselves in a particular way, our place in the universe. And now we realize that we haven't been correct about where we fit in the scheme of things. Arrogance combined with ignorance has made some of us think we're at the top of the heap. We're the big shots in the universe. And until recently, we thought, well, there's only one solar system. Until the 20s, we thought there was only one galaxy. If there were anybody out there, they would have landed here a long time ago and said hi and let's have lunch. Now we begin to realize that, wait a minute, the universe is bigger and older than we'd like to think it is. Our role is less and less than we'd like to think it is. We've got a lot to learn. And we don't like to be reminded that maybe we're not at the top of the heap. So I'd like to go over some of the things that have led me to a different view of where we fit in the greater scheme of things. I put this first just because it's kind of an interesting story. I hope some of you heard this last year. Chase Brandon worked for the CIA for more than 30 years. And he went public last year saying that when he was in a secret historical facility, stumbled across a box that had stuff about Roswell in it, and you know what? Roswell really happened. There were really aliens on board. And boy, did that stir things up. The CIA won't say yay. They don't really say nay, but this caused some consternation. Lee Spiegel there on the right, I've known Lee a long time. He set up the presentation to the United Nations. I hope you all are aware that there was a presentation to the United Nations in the late 70s. It didn't cause much influence, but it was interesting anyway. I enjoyed being there and speaking to the UN. But it sort of contrasts. Lee was the chairman of the International UFO Congress, the 22nd annual one, just a couple of weeks ago. So he's still at it. And the funny thing about this is that when I first heard this story, I said, "You're sure it's Chase Brandon?" Because the producer of my movie, UFOs Are Real, is Brandon Chase. And I thought, boy, that's too much of a coincidence, you know. But and there are copies available on my table out front. Not a bad one. So that's just to get a new tone for things. Okay. Now, we have to recognize, I as a scientist have to admit that science has frequently been wrong. I have a whole book outside. Science was wrong. Brilliant thinkers who said stupid things, which delayed progress in many areas. We've come to realize that the universe is bigger, older than had been thought. And that SETI, I'm a non-fan of SETI, which stands for Silly Effort to Investigate. Their perception of how things are is quite off the wall. And we'll get into that as we go along. But the whole point is our grandchildren will have a very different view, I hope, of what we have at this time about how things are out there and where we fit. You realize we thought there was only one galaxy until 1924? Now we know there are billions of galaxies. That's not just a little mistake. It's a very large mistake. We don't understand how things happen and how they have been happening. That's Hubble. And one of the reasons I show this, he was connected with the University of Chicago, which is my alma mater, so got to give him credit. We didn't know the process that produced the energy in the sun until 1938. It's been going along out there for 4.5 billion years. We smart earthlings suddenly realized, hey, maybe there's something different going on there. Nuclear fusion. You realize we didn't even know there were neutrons until 1931. We were pretty ignorant of what the world is like, both the large and the small. And it's we need to recognize that as smart as we are, we got a long way to go. And that there may be others who got there before we did. We don't like to think that's true, but it is. And this is important because fusion may be the key to unlocking interstellar travel, as I said this morning. Nuclear fusion is a process which we use in our usual Earthling fashion in H-bombs. What better to do with an entirely new energy production process than kill people? That's what we're all about here. You can imagine how aliens must look upon us. Are we using fusion to produce power? Oh, no, we can't do that. But we've got stockpiles of H-bombs to kill people. Something a little twisted about that approach to things. I showed this morning, different fusion reactions. The important thing, and that's where we have to recognize how ignorant we are. The important thing is that first line, 18.3 MeV, million electron volts. That's a measure of energy. One little reaction between those two isotopes and normal reactions are electron volts, and this is million electron volts. You get the idea there may be a source of energy here that we're not tapping yet, except for killing. And maybe somebody else out there has tapped a long time ago for travel, for energy production. The nice thing is that isotopes of hydrogen and helium are the most abundant ones in the universe. You can use uranium, but you won't find uranium everywhere. And it's very heavy. Hydrogen's very light. And everywhere you go, you're going to find uranium. I mean, you're going to find hydrogen. And what's funny is, when I say that, you realize that there are many people who, when they talk about going to the stars, assume you got to carry all the fuel for the whole trip from the start. It's like saying you got to drive from here to Seattle, but you got to carry all the gas for the whole trip. And you can't use air, you got to use liquefied air. So you got a big tank. That's a dumb way to do things. So fusion gives us the option of refueling in a lot of different places. That's a lot easier than carrying everything along for the trip. Now, we're not talking about it's a little more efficient in energy production per pound. We're talking about 10 billion times as much energy as in chemical combustion. That's a lot of room for improvement. if we're smart enough to figure out how to do it, which is the hard part. And until very recently, we thought there weren't any other planets out there. If there were, we would know about it, wouldn't we? Well, finally, we built the Kepler spacecraft. It's a marvelous instrument. I don't know if you realize, it's going in orbit, an elongated orbit, looking over and over again at a chunk of the sky about as big as my fist at arm's length. That's all, just this big. And yet we can spot planets going in front of their stars. Think of a butterfly going in front of the headlight on a car a mile away, and you being able to detect that the butterfly went by. Very sensitive. And what has Kepler told us? There are planets everywhere, all over the place out there. Some families of planets, some big ones, some small ones. We find planets that are as big as stars, tiny ones, ones that are close to their stars, ones that are far from their stars, some that are a lot older than the sun. I don't mean just a little bit. I mean billions of years older than the sun. And we have the gall to think we've got the only place in town? That's pretty far out. Pretty silly. Yeah, the contrast between what the SETI people were saying, that there might be as many as 8,000 places in the solar system, in the galaxy, that could be sending us signals. Now, of course, the question is, why would they send us signals using equipment that's appropriate to us? We've had radio less than 200 years. You know anything else that we're using that hasn't changed in 200 years? I don't. Why would they send us signals using technology appropriate to us now here? And more important, why would they send us signals in the first place? What are they going to say? Hey, guys, you got a football team we can play? Can we have a conference? You know, why would they send us signals? They've got nothing better to do, of course. They don't interact with each other. We're the centerpiece of the universe. Hardly. Let's hope we're not, for goodness sakes. And what is really strange, and I don't understand it, but I have to live with it, I guess. I read the books of the SETI people. They don't read the books of the UFO people. They won't admit that there is any information out there. And you say, well, why? Aren't they scientists? Well, yeah, but if they admit that aliens are coming here, who needs SETI? You know, think about that for a minute. Maybe you need to learn sign language for when they land. They don't consider that. No UFOs, no evidence for UFOs, no references to the UFO books, even the ones by other astronomers. Can't do that. Very strange. But at least we know now that there are planets, big ones, small ones, double ones, triple ones, quadruple ones, all over the place out there. They're the rule, not the exception. Strange as that might sound now, compared to 20 years ago. So we have to take into account that our view that we're special has no basis in fact other than that we're ignorant. We don't know about anybody out there, so we must be it. That's pretty silly. There's Dr. Drake, radio telescopes, Dr. Jill Tarter. They're bright people protecting their jobs. She's just retired. Now she's going to raise money for SETI. You can't lose interest, she said, because when you're so close to something so important as the possible first discovery of other life, how can you drop it? You may have seen her in a television show in which she and her husband were flying a plane and saw a light in the sky. Oh, no, it couldn't be a UFO, could it? No, it turned out to be the moon. clouds were in the way. That was the best UFO sighting she could come up with. Pretty darn silly. She might have talked about the RB-47 case. Kind of neat, not far from here. Started over the Gulf of Mexico, a reconnaissance plane. They see a UFO, six-man crew, very highly trained, all kinds of sophisticated equipment. UFO circles around them. They're flying 450 miles an hour. They pick it up on their radar. They radio the ground. The military on the ground see them and the UFO. This goes on for over an hour. Fly over the Gulf, over Texas, Oklahoma. They picked up a signal, electromagnetic signal from the object. Carl Sagan had an explanation when I was talking to him. Oh, that was spoofing, Stan. That's where you create an artificial signal where there is no target for radar. I said, Carl, there was a visual sighting lasting an hour. Oh, I guess I better look at that again. Yes, Carl. I wish you were here to look at it again. Radio telescopes, I'm not opposed to the use of radio telescopes to find out about the universe. They're an interesting measuring device that tells us lots of things. Is it going to find us life out there? So far, they have not found one indication of somebody sending us radio signals. Now, I have to tell you a little story. Before the Second World War began, a German general was informed that the English were building these 200-foot-tall towers along the English Channel with a crossbar at the top aimed toward Europe. Aha, he said, they must be developing radar in secret. We must find out. So believe it or not, they flew the Graf Zeppelin slowly, 70 miles an hour, over the water, checking out these towers as they went by. All kinds of monitoring gear to find out what frequency the Brits were using so they could jam it if war began, as it did not too long thereafter. And they made a slow pass. They didn't pick up any signal. Oh, we got to do this again. This is ridiculous. What else could they be doing with these things besides setting up radar? And we need to know what their characteristics are. So they sent a second pass. Only this time, they strayed over land. There was a big international incident. Sorry about that, folks. The wind blew us off course. That's what the Americans said when the U-2 plane was downed in the Soviet Union. Just the wind blowing us off course until Khrushchev said, well, here's the camera and the crewman. And Ike finally had guts enough to say, no, that's not what was going on. We were spying. Because we have a closed society, we need to know what they're doing. But okay, back to the German general. So, the strange thing is, those were radar installations. And they were picking up the graph as it went by. They were looking at a wrong frequency by a factor of 10. Now, here we have German scientists and English scientists who went to school with each other, published in the same journals, attended the same conferences. And we couldn't, the Germans couldn't correctly predict what frequencies and other characteristics their English would use. But somehow we earthlings can predict what aliens will be using, about whom we know next to nothing. It makes no sense. It's wishful thinking. And then we have the British Astronomer Royal. I think one could probably do a whole book about the stupid things those guys have said over the years. One of my favorites is in 1956, space travel is utter bilge, they said. Who would pay for it? What good would it do? What we really need to do is develop better instruments for doing astronomical research. That was less than 2 years before Sputnik. And what field of science has benefited most from space travel? Astronomy. The Hubble telescope being a good example. Well, here's Lord Rees. He has said other stupid things in the past, but he outdid himself last year. Somebody apparently asked him about UFOs. He said, only kooks see UFOs. No basis for that statement. No reference to existing sources of data in which only kooks see UFOs. It got wide coverage, I suppose, because some people realize what a stupid thing it was to say. Astronomers have trouble being realistic about the world outside. There are books by astronomers about UFO sightings. I showed one this morning, Dr. J. Allen Hynek's book. Dr. Peter Sturrock of Stanford did a book with the survey results of members of the American Astronomical Society, a number of whom have reported seeing UFOs. That's not to say anything about the thousands, literally, of sightings by airline pilots. I suppose he doesn't fly. Maybe he doesn't care. Surely he wouldn't put his life in the hands of somebody who's kooky and sees UFOs. I mean, it really is mind-boggling that these guys can get away with this kind of garbage. Don't need to give any sources. Research by proclamation, that's what matters. I showed this picture this morning to Seth Shostak, nice guy, Dr. Seth Shostak. We debated on Coast to Coast. Any of you hear that debate? Only one. Two. Okay, that's better than one. Anyways. We debated in a friendly fashion. We had met each other on the Queen Elizabeth II on a free trip from England to the United States. We each gave three lectures. We each attended the lectures of the other one. We were cordial. We were not giving each other a hard time. In the course of my lecture, I talked about five large-scale scientific studies. And I asked after each one, how many of you have read this? We had full houses for the lectures. The people, what else are you going to do on a QE2? In the North Atlantic in winter. Not sunning yourself out where it's hot. Couldn't do that. And Seth didn't raise his hand for any of those sources. And when we debated on Coast to Coast, I won the debate. 57-33-10, if you want the numbers. 10 said, I don't know who won, 10%. And Seth did admit a year later, I had sent him a copy of my book, Flying Saucers and Science, with his permission. And somebody asked when he was on Coast to Coast. And he admitted he had the book. It was on his nightstand. Hadn't read it, but it was on his nightstand. And maybe by next year he will read it. I don't know. I think he's afraid to, frankly. And I'd be happy to take him on again if anybody can arrange a debate. Nice man. However, knows nothing about flying saucers, is unwilling to look at the evidence, read the books, reference the data, because SETI is scared. They know that their position is unscientific. They have no basis for saying aliens are transmitting signals to us that we can pick up with our equipment and interpret. I mean, are they using AM or FM, you know, digital or analog? A few little questions like that stand in the way. Okay, so SETI isn't going to tell us about life out there or life out there that's coming here. I love the work of Bishop Usher. He concluded, he went through the Bible, a lot of begatting going on in the Bible. You want a sexy book. Begat. He figured out the world was created in 4004 B.C. I believe it was in October on a Thursday afternoon. That was the beginning. Now, he wasn't just a little off. 4004 B.C., if he had six more zeros in there, 4004 B.C., well, I'd concede that was a possibility. That's being quite a bit off. A billion or so factor. So his way of looking at the cosmos assumed that except for those people that are mentioned in the Bible, there would nothing before that. That's a pretty silly assumption. We've got all kinds of astronomical work, geological work that says the universe is billions of years old. And no, we didn't have the techniques to do that work 100 years ago. We do now. Why not take advantage of it? I got a kick out of the poor guys who pushed plate tectonics. What do you mean? You think the continents. We're moving. What are you, crazy? Any 10-year-old can look at the globe and say, well, gee, South America and Africa, you put them together, they must have been right next to each other, judging by the shape of both. Oh, no, 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 no. Planets, continents can't move. But they can. We got all kinds of evidence now. It's hard to get research done, however, when the powers that be say, that's nonsense. Why waste your money on that kind of garbage? We know it's impossible. The original title of my book, Science Was Wrong, with Kathleen Martin, was supposed to be, it's impossible, isn't it? There have been lots of declarations of impossibility which turned out to be wrong, flat out wrong. So Bishop Usher was probably a nice guy. He didn't know a darn thing about the creation of the Earth or the solar system or the galaxy or the universe. Here are four sources of information. You won't find them talked about by the astronomers. These are about UFOs. Three of the people in that second volume from the left, the symposium before Congress, were astronomers. Do they get consulted? Oh, no way. They hope the press will ignore this work. Dr. J. Allen Hynek on the right only had 20 years of involvement with UFOs as the official Air Force consultant. Why would you look at what he had to say? Because if you're after the truth, you go to the people who have spent the most time, effort, and money investigating. And he's one of those people. Instead, we're listening for signals. I hope some of you have heard about the cartoon. The cop comes along, and here's this guy crawling along on the ground under the streetlight. What are you doing down there? I'm searching for my keys. Well, where'd you lose them? Well, down there where my car is. Well, what are you looking here for? There's more light here. We're listening for radio signals because that's the easiest way we know how to do it. It's very easy because we're not getting any signals, so it doesn't take a lot of work. Strange world we live in. Now, one of the objections made by lots of people, but especially the astronomical community, is secrets can't be kept by governments. Everybody knows that. Seth gave two examples when we were both on Larry King. Look how FEMA fouled up with Katrina. That's governments can't keep secrets? Look how the post office is run. Badly, he said. There's no connection between that and national secrecy, security. Dr. Tyson of the Hayden Planetarium said, the proof that governments can't keep secrets is clear. Look how much we know about President Clinton's genitalia. Now think about that for does it make any sense to anybody? What happened to the CIA and the DIA and the NSA and the ONI? Their collective black budget every year, not under direct congressional control, is estimated at $50 billion. That's a lot of secrets. Our first successful spy satellite. I mean, first of all, the U-2 was developed in secret. The Russians knew we were flying over there. They didn't admit it. They didn't want to be able to have to tell their people that we couldn't do anything about it. The United States didn't tell anybody about flying U-2s to spy on the Soviet Union because it was against international law. So both countries kept the secret, not because they agreed and say, hey, Joe, you don't want to talk about this, do you? Nah, let's not. They both had their own implicit interest at hand. And finally, when they shot down Gary Powers' U-2, we lied. That was the first impulse. Just blown off course. And then Khrushchev showed the camera and the pilot, and he didn't take a cyanide pill. Bad boy. Think about that one for a minute. The successor to the U-2 was the Corona spy satellite. The first one was launched in 1960. got more data about Soviet military installations than all the U-2 flights that had preceded it. And we kept launching them. They had a great system for getting the data back. Kodak developed some super cameras. And they'd record film, and then they'd deorbit, and airplanes would come by and catch the film that was coming back in. That sounds weird as can be. This is out over the Pacific. But it worked. It worked. Now, did we pronounce that to the world? Hey, look what we did. We spied on the Soviet Union with a satellite that goes around and around and around. Nope. 1995. First successful one, 1960. 1995, before it was admitted. The National Reconnaissance Organization office, really, NRO, they build the big spy satellites. You know, the ones that can read the license plates in the Kremlin parking lots. Big, big organization. They admitted about 4 years ago that they had canceled a program they had with Boeing to develop a better spy satellite architecture, how they arrange the components. They'd only spent $13 billion, and they hadn't gotten what they wanted, so they canceled the program. All done in secret. Governments can't keep secrets? Who's kidding who? The radio astronomers, the astronomical community is kidding themselves. Then there's the Manhattan Project. That was what we set up to develop the atomic bomb. And it was done in secret. All kinds of money spent in all kinds of places, from Oak Ridge to Hanford to Los Alamos, a lot of other places. Spent several billion dollars. And many of the, well, Vice President Harry Truman had been a senator. Then he was elected to vice presidency in 1944. He knew nothing about the Manhattan Project as vice president. And it was only 13 days after President Roosevelt died in 1945 that Secretary of War Stimson had to brief President Truman about the Manhattan Project. As first senator and then vice president, he knew nothing about it. Secrets can be kept. And they often are being kept. So it's one of those stupid arguments because it's not based on data, evidence, checking through the files, doing your homework. You have to admit something you don't know if you go looking for new information, that there might be something you don't know. There's still a lot of nuclear secrets. The stealth aircraft, incidentally, based upon some Russian scientific work on how signals reflect from different surfaces and stuff like that. Anyway, we spent $10 billion, Lockheed, to develop the stealth aircraft over 10 years in secret. Of course, secrets can be kept. There's the Corona spy satellite. I would love to have been in an airplane watching as the canister, the data canister, came down from Corona and got netted by the passing airplane. Can you imagine what people would have thought if they saw that? I mean, this was out over the Pacific. Nobody saw it, I guess, but pretty neat. And I showed some of these before. Government documents about UFOs. Now, it took us a long time to get any of these. A group called Citizens Against UFO Secrecy went after the CIA back in the 80s. We want all your UFO documents. We don't have any. You do too. We do not. We appeal. They deny. We go to court. Judge says do a search under Freedom of Information. Okay, they came back. Oh, yeah, look, we found about 900 pages. Oh, and yeah, we found 56 documents that originated with other agencies. We can't release those. It's all about UFOs, you understand. Okay, they didn't release anything that was top secret. But amongst that list of 57 documents from other agencies were a bunch from the NSA, National Security Agency. So we filed a Freedom of Information Act request for those. Sorry, national security, sources and methods, we can't release anything, said the NSA. Their justification to a federal court judge was 18 pages long, about 80% blacked out, something like this document you see up there now. Well, after time goes by and President Clinton signed a new executive order requiring that all old classified information be declassified within 25 years. And everybody knew Clinton wasn't going to be reelected in 96, so the Air Force, the Army, the Navy did nothing about going through their old documents. You could keep it classified if you could justify it, but you have to sort and sift and throw out the stuff that shouldn't have been kept classified. Well, Clinton did get reelected, and then suddenly the Air Force is looking at 100,000 pages a month. And it turns out there was a lot of highly classified material. And finally, the NSA says, well, maybe we should release that old stuff. And I heard a rumor, so I called the NSA Freedom of Information Office. Understand you're putting out a lot of UFO documents. Well, yes, sir. Well, how do I get a copy? Well, what's your name, sir? My name is Stanton Friedman. Oh, we know about you. That worried me a bit. Oh, why is that? Well, Phil Klass, avionics, senior avionics editor for Aviation Week and Space Technology, and one of the biggest debunkers of UFOs, called us and told us that you show those blacked out documents on television and you don't tell people that it's for sources and methods information that's keeping withheld. So we are putting out a new set, and I got a set of those documents. No blacked out material. It was all whited out. Honest. And you can read about three lines per page. And people said, why don't you scrape off the blackout on those CIA documents and the whiteout and see what's underneath? They Xerox it first. There's nothing underneath. So this is a typical CIA UFO document, top secret, Umbra. You notice the words that are declassified. Title, doc reference, Soviet, USSR. Oh, that's highly classified, you know. Pretty silly stuff. And so let's look. I think the next one is an NSA. Yeah, that's a classified NSA UFO document, top secret Umbra. And everything's whited out except that little bit in the middle. And anybody who's got any sense knows that it can't be that 97% of this page is sources and methods and only 3% is material information. Can governments keep secrets? Of course they can. And the White House even responded falsely. They had a situation for a while where you could submit a petition if you got 25,000 names on it. You could request that they answer a certain question, and that was done for UFOs. No, we're not keeping anything secret about UFOs. What do you call that? I mean, I had people call me, Stan, their NSA is releasing their UFO materials. I said, can you read what's under that whiteout? Well, no, but then they're not releasing it. You don't see this in the New York Times or the Washington Post. Because we know the government can't keep secrets. It would be nice if any of you happens to have managed to get unredacted copies of these documents. These are all old ones, incidentally. All this stuff is pre-1980. A lot of years since then. NSA has lots of spy satellites. They've gathered lots of information. But they ain't telling us. And the New York Times isn't going after it. One of my favorite comments is by General Carol Bolander, Air Force General. He was an engineer, a good one, worked on the lunar excursion module, which we successfully launched in 1969. Well, in early 69, the University of Colorado study, Dr. Condon had recommended that Project Blue Book be closed. because it wasn't contributing anything to science or intelligence. And I agree with that. It wasn't contributing much to anything. Anyway, the Air Force asked General Bolander, now that he wasn't working 12-hour days, as he put it to me when I talked to him 10 years later on the lunar excursion module, what should we do about Project Blue Book? Now, he came at it completely unbiased because he had nothing to do with it before this time. Okay, so he wrote a memo which caused the closure of Project Blue Book at the end of 1969. He said, reports of UFOs which could affect national security are not part of the Blue Book system. He said they're made in accordance with JNAP 146, Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146, or Air Force Manual 55-11, and are not part of the Blue Book system. Two paragraphs later, he said if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report UFOs. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security, they're the ones I'm interested in, will continue to be made using the procedures adapted for that purpose. Well, I didn't see this until 10 years after it was written, and I managed to locate General Bolander and explain that I'd had a clearance for 14 years, very interested in UFOs, and was reading his memo. And I said, it sounds to me like you were saying that there were two separate channels for communications about UFOs. One dealing with the reports which could affect national security, and the other run-of-the-mill UFO stuff. He said, yes. And we talked about an example would be that a UFO going down the runway at a Strategic Air Command base where nuclear weapons were stored, that would be a national security problem. It ain't supposed to be anything there. But if you and I just go outside here and look up at the sky and there's some UFOs going over, big deal, happens all the time. Mutual UFO Network is getting 600 reports a month. 600 a month. And most people don't report their sightings. And yet, if you write the Air Force about UFOs and the Air Force, oh, we're not doing anything about UFOs. No UFO report evaluated, examined, investigated by the United States Air Force gives any evidence of being a threat to the security of the United States. Of course, if one of those three functions was done by somebody else, it's still a true but totally meaningless statement. The official Air Force statement is also no evidence of technology beyond our knowledge. Well, I know how to get to the stars with fusion propulsion systems. It's not beyond our knowledge. We haven't accomplished it yet. We haven't spent the $20 billion it might cost to do it. So, keeping secrets? Yeah, we're still keeping secrets. Try to get unredacted versions of the NSA and CIA UFO documents. And then tell me that they're not keeping secrets. They are. I don't think those statements from General Bolander have appeared in any major newspaper. Look for radio signals. But anybody looking in depth in how technology has changed over the last, let's say, 120 years, let's say since 1900, because a lot of new stuff came into being place technology after 1900, it always comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. Every field you turn to. Today's computers aren't just more compact slide rules. Marconi, you want an interesting trip, go up to Newfoundland. It's a half hour ahead of us time-wise, where I live in New Brunswick. People find that strange, but half hour time zone up there, Newfoundland time. The first long-distance radio signal was sent by Marconi from England to Signal Hill in St. John's, Newfoundland. And there's a room there, a building, a sort of a museum. That was in 1901. And you know what? All the great scientists said, what are you, crazy? Don't you know that radio waves travel in straight lines? And incidentally, the Earth is round. So if you want to send a signal any distance on the Earth, it only goes a couple hundred miles before it ain't near the ground no more, man. Marconi knew better than that. He sent signals and received at increasing distances. And the numbers you calculate by assuming the Earth is round and this is a straight line don't hold. So he knew he was in pretty good territory when he sent those signals to Signal Hill. And it made a big difference, incidentally. A lot of lives were saved because they were sending radio signals from ships, Morse code mostly, to tell people that there has been a disaster, some kind of a wreck, some kind of an accident, some kind of terrible things. Get the troops here, so to speak. Get the Navy here. A lot of lives saved. And it turned out it was 20 years later before we figured out why radio worked over long distances. It was a layer of the ionosphere that reflected those radio waves. Wouldn't even know it was there. That's how smart we are. We discovered it by accident. Many great discoveries are made by accident. But somebody willing to look again and say, oh, you know, I'm not sure that what's going on here. I'm not so smart that I know everything. Maybe I better check on this a little more. That's what led to great discoveries. So Marconi was a sharp guy. It wasn't just by accident that he was successful, though. He had done his homework. Now, to give an example of what I mean when I say progress comes from doing things differently, if you go back to 1523, one of Ferdinand Magellan's ships circumnavigated the globe, went all the way around Earth, and it took 3 years. Magellan didn't make it. That's why I say his ship, not him. 3 years. Jules Verne came up with Around the World in 80 Days in 1873. Well, that's quite an improvement. The International Space Station goes around every 90 minutes. So we go from 3 years to 90 minutes in less than 500 years. But not by using better sailboats. By using entirely new technology, a new approach. That's how progress gets done. So why are we stuck with listening for radio signals instead of looking at the UFO evidence? Because we don't want to know that aliens are visiting. It would upset the apple cart. Too bad, is what I say. Now, some of you may recognize that's a slide rule on the left, part of one. And a modern calculator on the right. And as I think I mentioned this morning briefly, I was lecturing in Michigan at a college and found that nobody in the large classroom of students knew what a slide rule was. I used one when I worked in industry. How many of you have used a slide rule? Quite a few. Not the youngest amongst you, I might add. Sorry, no insult meant. I'm one of the older guys here, so. But it did its job. It was a fine instrument. But that little device on the right can do a heck of a lot more in a heck of a lot less time. And you don't need to be an expert at doing it. Just punch numbers in a little calculator. It's not that there was something wrong with the slide rule, but there's a better way of doing the same things and many more things. And I showed these nuclear rockets this morning. On the left, the Los Alamos one. On the right, the Westinghouse one. And there is one that Aerojet built, similar, same idea. The basic concept is to take advantage of the fact that a nuclear fission produces a heck of a lot more energy than a chemical reaction. And we've built these systems. It's not something we just talk about, not an exercise. The one on the left is the Phoebus. The biggest one was 4,400 megawatts, twice the power, as I said this morning, of Grand Coulee Dam. In something less than 8 feet in diameter. Think about that for a minute. The one on the right, only 1,100 megawatts, but I worked on that one. That's why I included it at Westinghouse. These were tested out at the nuclear test site, not far from Area 51. This goes over the whole question of how do you get to the stars and how do you do a lot of other things. Then I go back to this data from Blue Book Special Report 14. I've heard more nonsense about what the government studies have found about UFOs than about almost anything else. I showed you the quote this morning from Secretary of the Air Force. Even the unknown 3% in this study could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. That was an official statement from the Secretary of the Air Force that got nationwide publicity. Except it was a lie. The unknowns were 21.5%, which is a long way from 3%. And I like the psychological aberrations. No room for aberrations there. There are crazy people in the world. And some of them probably claim to have seen UFOs. So what? There are plenty of non-crazy people who claim to have seen UFOs. That means a lot. Including pilots, scientists, even astronomers. So when anybody starts mouthing off about there ain't no data, folks, they're not telling the truth. And the quality evaluation, the better the quality, the more likely to be unexplainable. Exactly what you'd expect if the unknowns are really different and exactly the opposite of what the debunkers try to claim. There is good evidence. This is old data. We got plenty of new data. But you don't see it because it's classified. You don't have a need to know. They tell us. Now here's what Carl Sagan said. The reliable cases are uninteresting. And the interesting cases are unreliable. Unfortunately, there are no cases that are both reliable and interesting. He gives no evidence for this, no reference, no basis. Look again. The better the quality, the more likely to be unidentifiable. They're the only interesting ones, after all. And as you'd expect, the less likely to be listed as insufficient information. Exactly what you'd expect if some of these things were really rather special. You'd never know it from the noisy negativists. To illustrate the problem, the most distinguished 19th century astronomer in the United States said, quote, "The demonstration that no possible combination of known substances, known forms of machinery, and known forms of force can be united in a practical machine by which man shall fly long distances through the air seems to this writer as complete as it is possible for the demonstration of any physical fact to be." How do you demonstrate a fact by saying there isn't any way to do it? Anyway, that statement was made 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight. And Dr. Newcomb was such a prominent astronomer, the President of the United States attended his funeral a few years later. It was baloney. That delicatessen is growing all day long here. Now, I mentioned nuclear fusion because I happen to like it as a way of doing things, like going to the stars. But the Navy has long since learned how to use nuclear fission. That's a nuclear-powered submarine on the left. It used to be that submarines were surface ships that could operate underwater for maybe a day. They needed oxygen for their diesel engines. The nuclear submarine allows them to stay underwater while going around the globe and taking periscope leave at Hawaii, I was told by one Navy guy. Now look at the right. That's a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. Carries 75 little airplanes. It operates for 20 years without refueling. That's a bit of an improvement. overusing tankers of diesel fuel. 20 years. And the airplanes operate for what? An hour, 2 hours, 3 hours? The analogous situation is a starship from another solar system to ours operating on, say, nuclear fusion, which then releases Earth excursion modules, as I like to call them, which flit around in the atmosphere. Now, for that to be true, you'd have to have reports of huge motherships. Yeah, we do. Huge space carriers, if you will. Great case out in the Yukon. 32 witnesses interviewed by an engineer, civil engineer, Martin Jasek, all up and down the Yukon Highway. Well, let's see, with the front end over that mountain and the back end over that lake and that sort of thing, he wrote a paper. That craft was between 0.6 and 1.2 miles long. Miles long. Yet there was a recent paper just a few months ago by a debunker trying to say, look, the only way you can use nuclear fusion is to explode it inside some kind of a fusion rocket, and there's nothing that can contain that explosion. And he talked about the size of the vehicles up to 300 feet. Well, between 0.6 and 1.2 miles is a lot more than 300 feet. In addition, we have cases like the Japan Airlines case. 747 heading toward Fairbanks, Alaska, coming from Iceland. And they spotted this object. They saw it out the window. They picked it up on their radar. It was twice the size of an aircraft carrier, they said. They talked to the ground. What's going on up here? They picked up the 747. They picked up the unknown. The crew asked for permission to change their course so they could fly in a circle. They got permission. The UFO station kept with them. Being seen on the ground by radar, by the plane's radar, and visually by the crew. Twice the size of an aircraft carrier. All the paperwork on that, unfortunately, was collected by the FAA and sent to the CIA in Washington. You can't get copies of it. But the pilot had spoken. And one of the FAA guys has opened his mouth as well. Twice the size of an aircraft carrier puts it about 2,000 feet long. So, yes, we have motherships. Now, I'm not saying it has to be fusion in there. I know that the world of the future will tell us about stuff we don't know anything about now. That's the way things happen. But the debunkers don't seem to realize that. I'm curious what it took to get that equals MC squared times 40. Get that painted on that ship. Now, another thing is, the SETI guys never talk about the way airplanes fly. You know, from city to city. They don't take off and say, where should we go now, guys? Is it random flights? Of course it isn't. Be a big waste of fuel. The reason I mention this is because you might want to look where stars have other stars close by. I mentioned this morning Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli, two stars in a constellation of reticulum, but only an eighth of a light year apart from each other. But you don't find people compiling the distances of the nearby stars from a particular star. You know, look at this map of airline travel. You don't go from San Francisco to the middle of nowhere in northwest Texas. You go to the big places, Houston and so forth. And that big blob over there in New York. But it isn't random. Now, people sometimes say to me, now look, Stan, why in the heck would anybody come to this planet? There's nothing special about it. The whole solar system is here. We're no any different from anybody else. I just heard this on the radio 3 days ago. Not seeming to realize the person who was saying it. He said, they're the same minerals available everywhere. Well, the density of the planets is not the same. Saturn is so light you could float it on a big bucket of water. The Earth is the densest planet in the solar system. And you say, who cares? And do I mean they're the stupidest? No, that's not what I'm saying. That's probably true, too. But average cubic foot of Earth weighs more than the average cubic foot of any other planet in the solar system. That means there are more heavy metals. And heavy metals are exciting metals. Uranium, gold, tungsten, rhenium, osmium, platinum. Osmium is twice as dense as lead, for example. You've heard the line, heavy as lead, light as balsa. Lead isn't heavy. And those metals that I named are rather exotic, with special characteristics, high melting points, and all kinds of utilities that we're just beginning to learn about now. So the planet is different, and it's covered with water. Now, we know there's been water on other planets in the neighborhood, but ain't none of them covered with a whole host of water. Three-quarters of the planet Earth is covered with water. Water is handy for lots of things. You want to set up a mining company? I'd recommend going underwater and picking up the diamonds that have washed into the ocean off Africa. Diamonds are worth a lot per handful. So is gold, for that matter. There's that the Betty and Barney Hill story with one of the models that Margie Fish built. It's a really creative way to look at this problem, incidentally. See if you can get a three-dimensional model that matches the two-dimensional drawing. And it only took 27 models to do it. I've met Marjorie. I was asked to help her. Very brilliant woman, member of Mensa. But this is just down the street now. Not another galaxy, not across her own galaxy, not hundreds of light years away. Like somebody who called last night on the George Noory show, thousands of light years, what are you talking about? 39 light years away, no big deal. But two sun-like stars, an eighth of a light year apart, just down the street from us. How many more are there within, instead of 39 light years in this case, say 60 light years, 100 light years? Nobody's looking at that data. They should be. There's Betty and Barney again and their dog. And I told the story this morning. Let's see. Dr. Susan Clancy has a Harvard PhD in psychology. She wrote a book about abduction, or why some people think they've been abducted by aliens. She said she's read everything on the subject. She's watched all the TV shows. And she gets everything wrong about the cases she talks about. It's really quite a remarkable performance. She talks about the Allagash abduction. That's a region in northern Maine. And there were four guys who went out on a camping trip, a set of twins and two friends, and they lost time. And under regressive hypnosis, it turns out that they were apparently abducted. Well, Susan talks about that case. She met one of the guys. She did a big study. She wanted to do a study in which she knew that the memories were wrong. She had looked at women. Well, that's what she said. She looked at, had been looking at women who claimed to have been sexually bothered when they were young. But the question is, were they or weren't they when they were 3, 4, 5 years old? And it's not easy to determine the truth of that. They said, I want to look at something where we can see that when we know that the stuff that's remembered is not true. Alien abductions. She didn't want to find out about alien abductions. She knew it wasn't true to start with. Well, when she talks about the Allagash case, she says she gave the date for the case, 10 years wrong. Said there were two witnesses. There were four. Said one of the two wrote a book about the case. The book was written by somebody else entirely, a good engineer, as a matter of fact, Raymond Fowler. And she quoted Seth Shostak as an expert on aliens. Don't ask me why. who said that Betty and Barney Hill were Mr. and Mrs. American Front Porch, Front Porch American. A mixed race couple in 1961 in New Hampshire is hardly Front Porch American. They couldn't even cohabit in Virginia. Miscegenation laws were still in place. Betty was a social worker, head of the adoption section at the state of New Hampshire. Barney worked for the post office, but was on the governor's civil rights commission. Took courage to do that. But Susan got it wrong. And she made comments about the Condon report, and she got those wrong. So she needed a fact checker at Harvard University Press. They apparently didn't have one. And this is one of the things that infuriates me about this field, that the debunkers keep mouthing off with things that are simply untrue, where they haven't done their homework and they don't give their references, and they act as if they're experts on this subject. To use a Yiddish word, that takes chutzpah. Top secret magic. I can't wait for the movie, Magic Men. It's been optioned for a movie. A screenplay has been written. Whether the movie will be made, I have no idea. But it's an interesting story. How we got a roll of film with some documents on it. And then suddenly the market is flooded with documents, most of which are fairly obviously fraudulent. Why? Why would somebody put out fraudulent documents about MJ-12, Majestic 12? They want people not to believe that it's true. Not by doing careful research, but by making proclamations. I spent a lot of time in archives tracking down those proclamations. I talked to the families of all but one of the members of MJ-12. I get people telling me, surely those guys would have told their wives. That's nonsense. I had a clearance for 14 years. I'd never told my wife anything classified. Wouldn't help her, and it wouldn't help me, and it might help the Russians. Loose ships sink ships. You know, you've heard that before. It's a very exciting puzzle. There's Philip Klass. He was in Washington, so he was the go-to guy by the networks. You might have seen us on, what's his name, Ted Koppel. We went at each other. On the day that Jackie Gleason died, that's how I remember whenever that was, we had a short and hard discussion on the program to do honor to the great one, who was very interested in flying saucers. Had an enormous library about them, incidentally. And I got that from Merv Griffin, among other people who knew Jackie. Anyway, Phil and I were... Shows you how they do things on television. We're supposed to be talking about the government cover-up. Well, okay, I go in with my blacked-out and whited-out documents. Oh, you can't bring those in with you. Well, why not? We're talking about government cover-up. Here's the proof. That's not how we do things. That's a little strange. That makes it into radio instead of television. You know, I could hold the documents up to the microphone, but you still can't see them, you know. Well, okay, then... Phil, you sit over here. Stan, you sit over here. Don't look at each other. Both of you, each of you, look at your camera. Now, the interesting thing was we never saw Ted Koppel. People said to me the next day, what was he like? I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? You did a program with him. He was not in the room. He was not on a monitor. I never saw him. You get none of those verbal, nonverbal cues, you know, from watching people. A smirk, a blink, whatever. It was a strange experience. And I would love to have been able to take a poll of the people who watched the show to find out who they say won the debate, so to speak. And dear Phil, on one of the documents, as I mentioned this morning, he said, perhaps you didn't notice that it was done in the large pica type. But... the National Security Council only used the small elite type, and I've got 9 documents to prove it. He got them from the Eisenhower Library by mail. He's never been there. And I will offer you $100 each for every genuine document from the NSC done in the same size and style type and signed, and there were several other criteria. Up to a maximum of 10, unfortunately. And he gave me 60 days. Well, I was going to the Eisenhower Library. He'd never been there. I'd spent weeks there, literally. And so I was going there. I gathered 14 that met all his criteria, made him copies, sent him an invoice for $1,000 because he limited it to 10, and he paid me. Told everybody about challenging me and nobody about paying me. That's the real scientific approach, you see. And as I recently found out, his files at the American Philosophical Society Library don't have a Friedman file. We had correspondence over more than a 20-year period. But we don't want the world to know that Uncle Phil was not correct. That's typical of this field. I also took him up on an offer. He was making big noises many years ago. He's putting his money on the table, and those UFO guys aren't. So we were doing a television program in Detroit, and I pulled $100 out of my pocket. I'm taking him up on his offer. He started to brag about nobody takes him up. Cash on the barrelhead, Phil. He shut up for a while. Not very long, but... There's his check to me, and I included it in a report I wrote. He sent me a scathing letter. He was going to sue me. His father was a lawyer for including that check. And I told him, well, politely, I said that you sent me a check. I Xeroxed it. I took it to the bank. The bank cashed it. I can do whatever I please with the Xerox, Phil, which is true. And he shut up. But you won't find it in his files. We don't want the public to know that the debunkers don't know what the heck they're talking about. That would be against the rules. You know, back to Betty and Barney again. There's Kathleen Marden, who's Betty's niece and who's the co-author on the book. She wrote 85% of the book, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. She is sort of head of abduction research for the Mutual UFO Network. Just finished a study in which she got dozens of abductees to describe the interior of the saucers and compared it, some of the answers to what people who had never been abducted said. It's an interesting body of data, which nobody else has compiled before. She was trained as a social worker and a teacher. Co-authored Science Was Wrong. There's my early book about Roswell. And in case you're wondering, what the heck has Corona got to do with anything? Oh, that was that spy satellite he was talking about. Well, it was, but Corona is the small town closest to where the Roswell event took place, just down the road, out in the middle of nowhere. And as a matter of fact, during the 50th anniversary, there used to be a movie theater in Corona, small town. And on the marquee, no movie theater, but the marquee is still there. Forget about Roswell. It all happened here. They love my book because I mentioned Corona instead of Roswell. Strange world we live in. I have a few copies of this left outside. Oh, here again, I love to show this picture of one of the crash test dummies that the Air Force says was responsible for the stories about alien bodies at Roswell. The dummy's the one in the middle. 6 feet tall, 175 pounds, in a flight outfit. My informant was on the right. Not only did he tell me that the dummy was 6 feet tall and 175 pounds, but he also reiterated that the drops weren't made until after 1953. Roswell was 47. There's a non-connection there. But he also told me that when he worked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, both he and his wife, who also worked there, had heard stories about bodies of aliens at the base. Furthermore, as an example of security, his boss was giving him a down rating because he wasn't satisfied with his work. But turns out he didn't know what Colonel, then Lieutenant Mattson, was doing. He was working for somebody else on the U2 program. Highly classified, his own boss didn't know what he was doing. How could he give him a good rating on something he didn't know what was going on? So it's an example of security. Not an unusual example. The need to know is very important. And one of the things that protects all the secrets of the intelligence agencies is the egos of the big shots in Washington. I'm an important person. If this were going on, I would know about it. Sure, great protection for covering secrets. They could honestly say they didn't know anything about that, which they probably didn't. That doesn't mean it didn't exist. I'm just imagining, I've spent a lot of time in New Mexico, out in the boondocks, and this is, it's pretty boondocks country. And, you know, the snakes, the scorpions, rattlesnakes, and so forth out there. But you wonder how many people realize how much classified work has been done in New Mexico. And why was it chosen for testing the first nuclear weapon and as the place where we fired all those captured German V-2 rockets? Because there ain't nobody there. Nobody minds you're sending rockets off if there's nobody to be hit by them when they land. And I should tell you, one of the things that I try to do is to envision how do we look to aliens besides just saying it's a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare, which is a pretty accurate description of us. But at the end of World War II, what could you say about our society? First of all, we're warlike. We killed 50 million of our own kind. That's not very nice. Second of all, we destroyed 1,700 cities. That's not very nice. Third, anybody checking us out would realize that there were three signs that soon we'd be able to bother them out there. Nuclear weapons, powered rockets used for destruction, not to send the mail from Germany to England. And third, powerful radar. Where does that figure in? Well, that's the beginning of the electronics revolution. There's only one place in the United States, 1947 July, we could check on all three of those trades, if you will, those technologies. Southeastern New Mexico. First atom bomb tested at Trinity Site on the grounds of the White Sands Missile Range. That's where we had our best radar to track the rockets because sometimes they went south instead of north, and the Mexicans weren't very happy about that. And we got radar, we got rockets, and we got nuclear. Put those all together, soon these idiot earthlings will be bothering us out there if we give them a chance. Let's not. I would refer you to the work of Robert Hastings, Nukes and UFOs. Gives many examples of aliens taking an interest in rockets with nuclear weapons on board them. Colonel Mattson is dead now, unfortunately. The Roswell Report, case closed. That's the second volume. The first one said they weren't going to say anything more, but they lied. A very good crash case, the Aztec incident. Used to be people dismissed it. But Scott and Suzanne Ramsey have done a bang-up job in getting new evidence, new data, new files on some of the people involved. I have a few copies left, plus there's the order blank. It's clear. I hate to say it, but man is not at the top of the heap. We're a threat to the neighborhood as a primitive society primarily involved in tribal warfare. Thanks for listening. I like this cartoon. When I was inducted into the Roswell UFO Hall of Fame, one of the local papers in New Brunswick did this cartoon. And I think it's kind of neat. Always nice to be recognized by your peers. I don't think there's another slide here. Oh, yeah. Yeah, look at all those books you can read. Thank you very much for listening.